ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Welcome to the Bible and Archaeology, studies into biblical archaeology and history. I am E. Raymond Capt, Bible archaeologist and research historian. Before the middle of the 19th century, the Bible was the only source for the Bible narratives before 550 B.C. Many believed the Old Testament, before Abraham, was a series of ancient fables, not confirmed by historical or archaeological evidence. However, archaeology has since made many discoveries that have shed light on the scriptures. Numerous critics of the Bible boasted of using so-called scientific methods, they claimed, to challenge the historical and geographical accuracy of the scriptures. However, since the middle of the 19th century, archaeologists excavating in the Bible lands have produced the evidence for confirming the penability of the Bible, disproving the accusations made against the scriptures, historically, geographical, and cultural. Who really wrote the book of Genesis? Moses or several writers, as some scholars claim, compiled what we call the Pentateuch? Was the source of information derived from ancient Babylonian tablets, as the critics of the Bible claim? To answer those questions, I will start with the first. Who wrote the book of Genesis? Let us mentally go back into time some 3,500 years ago. A man sits alone in his black goat hair tent. A sheet of parchment lies spread out before him. The sputtering light of a little pottery lamp throws dancing shadows against the tent walls. That he is not an indoor man is evident from his leathery, wind-burned skin, his deeply tanned shoulders. Though he is not much past 40 years of age, his hair and his beard are already sprinkled with gray. Now he leans forward and begins to write, laboriously, carefully, on the parchment before him. His eyes burn like coals as he concentrates on his work. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, he writes. He is putting down a great majestic epic that had been handed down from father to son for some 40 centuries. He had heard the stories many times from his own mother during those first years of his life before being sent to the palace. Now, some impelling force seems to command him to write out the story of the history of the world from the days of creation down to his own lifetime. As he writes, the words seem to flow through his mind, refreshed and alive, just as though he had heard the stories only yesterday. Late into the night, he writes, until the flickering oil lamp grows dim, and his eyes are heavy with weariness. Then he lays aside his pen, extinguishes the lamp, and stretches out in his sheepskin blanket beside his wife and two sons. The work of recording does not go quickly, for during the daylight hours he must watch his father-in-law's herds of sheep and goats, leading them back and forth through the wilderness, ever searching for fresh grass and forage. The man's name is Moses. Moses had been born into a slave family in the land of Egypt. Then, through the miraculously hand of Providence, he had been adopted into the royal ruling family of Egypt. As a growing boy, he had been educated in all the arts and sciences of Egypt. However, his early training by his mother, disguised as a foster mother, revealed to him his Hebrew identity, which prevented him from accepting the idolatrous sun worship of the priests of Amun-Ra. It appears possible he could have obtained the throne of Egypt, had it not been for his tenacious in refusal to accept the national religion of Egypt. Because of the killing of an Egyptian mistreating one of his own people, young Moses was forced to flee the country. In the adjacent desert where he found sanctuary, he was invited to make his home with a desert chieftain and his family, and while there he married one of the daughters and began to raise a family. During his desert years, Moses wrote what we now know as the Book of Genesis, a history of the world from the time of creation up to the exodus of the nation of Israel from Egypt. Later, after Moses had gone back into Egypt and had successfully led the nation of Israel out of Egypt, he wrote four other books. The Exodus, a story of the nation's escape from their slavery, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, books that describe other details of the life and laws of the people during their 40-year trek from Egypt to the land of Canaan. Moses wrote these first five books of the Bible, known as the Pentateuch, and perhaps the book of Job about 3,500 years ago. After this, other writers added their contributions, some of the books historical in character, some of them poetry, and some prophetic exhortations to God's people Israel. A total of some 28 to 30 writers were involved in the writings of the Old Testament, the last author making his contribution about 1,000 years after the time of Moses. These books of Moses and the prophets were held by the people of Israel to be direct messages from God speaking to them. Again and again, the writers had used the expressions such as, "Thus saith the word of God," "Thus saith the Lord," and "God said, the word of the Lord came to me saying." I have presented the prevailing belief that Moses wrote from memory, what he had been told, stories handed down from generation to generation. However, archaeology has revealed another source for the information that Moses wrote, cuneiform clay tablets. But first, a word about writing. It is probable that the earliest times the thoughts of men were set down in writing by the use of pictures or signs. In time, these developed into line pictures because straight lines were more easily inscribed on such substances as stone or clay. When clay became the common writing material, the series of wedges were impressed on the plastic clay so as to form the pictures. In time, the pictures were almost entirely abandoned, and groups of wedges formed the words. Thousands of clay tablets have been found written before the patriarchal age, and over a quarter of a million cuneiform clay tablets are distributed among the various museums of the world. A conservative estimate is that the pictographic writings began before 3500 B.C., that is some 2,000 years before Moses. Picture writing became replaced by cuneiform writing about 2800 B.C., when examples began to come to light in archaeological excavations in Mesopotamia. These clay cuneiform tablets were made by the use of a wedge stylus of metal or wood, marking soft clay which was later dried in the sun or baked in an oven for hardening. The signs were made up of single wedges placed parallel at various angles or across each other. By this means, nearly 600 entirely independent and distinct signs were made by the use of from 2 to 30 wedges. Cuneiform tablets have confirmed many biblical narrations or records. A typical example is a tablet written for Hammurabi, dealing with Amraphel, who was chased by Abraham, as recorded in Genesis chapter 14. In Egypt, where the papyrus plant flourished, papyrus became the usual material on which to write. One early manuscript still in existence is dated about 3000 B.C. Moses, soon after he left Egypt, began his career as a scribe for God. It is possible that he used tablets, for the Ten Commandments were written on two tablets, not tables, of stone. The Hebrew verb to write means to cut in, a reference to the original method of writing on clay tablets. When the Israelites had crossed over into Sinai, and immediately after their battle with Amalek, we read in Exodus 17, verse 14, And the Lord said unto Moses, Write this for a memorial in a book. After God had given the covenant to him on Mount Sinai, we read, And the Lord said unto Moses, Write thou these words. And he wrote upon the tablets the words of the covenant. That was found in Exodus 34, verses 27-28. As soon as God gave Moses the first part of the law, we read in Exodus 24, verse 4, that, quote, Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, unquote. The books of Deuteronomy, Leviticus, and Numbers made references to Moses' writing. Some important elements of ancient writing should be noted. These provide the very clues to Moses' source of information. These are elements that answer the questions. What literary methods were used in early days? What style and form did they adopt for their various documents? How and where did they sign and date their letters and other tablets? Seeing that clay tablets cannot be stitched, as can pieces of parchment or the pages of a book, what means were used to connect tablets together and preserve the proper sequence when more than one tablet was necessary in order to obtain or contain a piece of writing? Ordinarily, clay tablets were made of sufficient size to contain all the writing matter to be inscribed, but in some instances, this was only achieved by using a small stylus, thus enabling a greater number of words to be written on the limited space available. It was not considered satisfactory to make a clay tablet too large for two good reasons. First, its liability to breakage, and second, consideration of weight and handiness. Very few tablets have been found, even 15 inches square. As a general rule, single tablets for ordinary documents, such as letters, contracts, invoices, and genealogical lists, was used. When, however, the lengthy nature of the writings required more than one tablet, it was just as necessary then as it is today, with the pages of letters or books, to adopt means to preserve their proper sequence, especially when a considerable number of tablets were required to complete the series. This was achieved by the use of titles, catch lines, and numbering. The title was taken from the first words of the first tablet. These were repeated at the end of each subsequent tablet, followed by the serial number of that tablet, just as a page is today numbered. By this method, not only the series to which each tablet belonged, but also the order in which they were to be read was indicated. As an additional safeguard, it was also the practice to use catch lines. That is, the first few lines of the subsequent tablets was repeated as catch lines at the end of the previous tablet. Also, it is noted that the scribes of Nineveh 2,500 years ago, when copying tablets which had been written 1,000 years earlier, ended the tablet with a short statement indicating from which library the original text had come. From these facts, it can be deduced that the book of Genesis was written on clay cuneiform tablets. The master key to the discovery of the composition of the book of Genesis is found in the proper use of the phrase, quote, these are the generations of. This key, if handled properly, solves every literary difficulty, critical or otherwise. All scholars appear to agree that this most significant and distinguishing phrase used in Genesis indicates successive stages in the process of the narrative. It was so important to the Septuagint translators, they gave the entire book the title Genesis, the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew word translated generations. We find that formula used in the following places in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. These are the generations of the heaven and the earth. Chapter 5, verse 1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. Chapter 6, verse 9, these are the generations of Noah. Chapter 10, verse 1, these are the generations of the sons of Noah. And finally, chapter 11, verse 10, these are the generations of Shem. The same phrase is used for Terah, Ishmael, Isaac, Esau, and Jacob. Most Bible scholars agree the phrase is important, but all seem to have misunderstood both its use and meaning. The reasoning is quite simple. Many of these sections commence, as is frequent in ancient documents, with a genealogy or a register asserting pure birth. This has led them to associate the phrase, "These are the generations of," with the genealogy list where this follows. Hence, they have wrongly assumed that the phrase is used as a preface of introduction, and that the person to whose name is prefixed is of sufficient importance to mark a break in the genealogical series, and that he and his descendants will form the subject of the section which follows, until another name is reached prominent enough to form the commencement of a new section. This assertion is plainly contrary to the facts. For if we examine the evidence regarding the latter part of the statement, we find the most prominent person in Genesis to be Abraham, and he would certainly be entitled to be named if this interpretation was true. And yet, lesser persons are mentioned, and there is no such phrase as, "These are the generations of Abraham." And further, the phrase does not always belong in a genealogical list, and in some cases, no genealogical list follows. In fact, the main history of the person named in each case has been written before the phrase and not written after it. When we read, "This is the book of the generations of Adam," we learn nothing more about Adam, excepting his age at death. The record following, "These are the generations of Isaac," is not so much a history of Isaac as that of Jacob and Esau. Similarly, after "These are the generations of Jacob," we read mainly about Joseph. In fact, this peculiarity has puzzled most Bible scholars. It should be clear, however, that this phrase is not an introduction or preface to the history of a person as is so often imagined. Consequently, it is important to ascertain the precise meaning of this phrase, "These are the generations of." The Hebrew word for generations is toledoth, which means history, especially family history. It also means the origin of anything or the story of their origin. Genesis 2 verse 4 should read, "This is the origin of the heavens and the earth." Bible scholars have stated toledoth signifies the history of the origin. In fact, Jewish scholars today call the book of the life of Jesus toledoth Jesu, or translated, "History of Jesus." So where we read, "These are the generations of," we should read, "These are the historical origins of," or "These are the beginnings of," which means the use of the phrase is to point back to the origins of the family history and not forward to a later development through a line of descendants. This is made abundantly clear in the New Testament, where in Matthew 1 verse 1 we read, "The book of the generation of Jesus Christ," following which is a list of ancestors. Here it means the exact opposite of the descendants, for it is used to indicate the tracing back of the genealogy to its origin. So in like manner, when we read, "This is the book of the histories of Adam," it is the concluding sentence of the record already written and not an introduction to a subsequent record. In one instance, the translators placed the formula in its right place. When in Genesis 2 verse 4 they wrote, "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth," for they recognized it obviously pointed back to the narrative of the creation contained in the previous chapter, and that it cannot refer to the narrative which follows. For this section contains no reference to the creation of the heavens. The phrase is only appropriate as a concluding sentence, so that most commentaries, notwithstanding their usual opposite interpretation of the words, make the story of creation end with them. Had they seen that all sections of Genesis are concluded by the use of this formula, that we have found the key to the composition of the book of Genesis. From a careful examination of the use of the name of the person stated at the end of, "These are the origins of," makes it clear that it refers to the owner or writer of the tablet, rather than to the history of the person named. An example, "These are the origins of Noah," does not necessarily mean this is the history of Noah, but the history written or possessed by Noah. When in Genesis chapter 11, verse 27, we read, "These are the generations of Terah," we do not read much about Terah, for it simply records that he was the son of Tabor. The phrase is intended to indicate to Terah that Terah either wrote or had written for him the list of ancestors found in verses 10 to 27. Nowhere is there, "These are the generations of Abraham." Yet his story has been fully written, for we are told that Isaac and Ishmael wrote or owned the tablets containing it. In the early days of writing, it was often the practice to impress the name of the scribe at the end of the tablets. The formula, "These are the generations of," was probably inserted by Moses as a compiler. It is therefore possible that the patriarchs mentioned in Genesis did not with their own hand impress the cuneiform or other ancient script on the stone or plastic clay. In some instances, a scribe may have been employed. We note the following points about the phrase. 1. It is a concluding sentence of each section and therefore points backwards to the narrative already recorded. 2. That the earliest records claim to have been written. 3. It normally refers to the writer of the history or the owner of the tablet containing it. In this way, Moses clearly indicates the source of the information available to him and names the persons who originally possessed the tablets from which he gained his knowledge. Such a remarkable confirmation of this is the fact that in no instance is an event recorded which the person or persons named could not have written from his own intimate knowledge or had obtained absolutely reliable information in his time. And it is most significant that the history recorded in these sections found ceases in all instances before the death of the person named. Yet in most cases it is continued almost up to the date of death, or the date in which it is stated that the tablets were written. Another literary aid is seen in the many tablets ending with a colophon. This was the equivalent of the modern title page. However, on ancient tablets, it was placed at the end of the written matter instead of at the beginning, as is done now. This colophon frequently included, among other things, the name of the scribe who wrote the tablet and the date when it was written. As these literary aids relate to the tablets as they come into the possession of Moses, it is, of course, unlikely that we should find them all in the documents as completed by him. Another literary aid may be observed in the book of Genesis, repetition of words and phrases, which is also found on ancient clay tablets to indicate the beginning and ending of each tablet. As found in Genesis, they are, chapter 1, verse 1, "God created the heavens and the earth." Chapter 2, verse 4, "Lord God made the heavens and the earth." Verse 4, "When they were created." Chapter 4, verse 2, "When they were created." Chapter 6, verse 10, "Shem, Ham, and Japheth." 10, verse 1, "Shem, Ham, and Japheth." Verse 1, "After the flood." Chapter 11, verse 10, "After the flood." Verse 26, "Abram, Nahor, and Haran." Verse 27, "Abram, Nahor, and Haran." Chapter 25, verse 12, "Abraham's son." Verse 19, "Abraham's son." Chapter 36, verse 1, "Who is Edom?" Verse 8, "Who is Edom?" Verse 9, "Father of the Edomites." Verse 43, "Father of the Edomites." The very significant repetitions of these phrases, where the tablets begin and end, have been buried in the text of Genesis, their significance apparently unnoticed. What we have is a practice carried out in the ancient East when two or more tablets form a series. They were identified together by the first few words of the first tablet being repeated in the colophon of the subsequent tablets. Somewhat similar to the way in which the name of a chapter is often repeated at the head of each page of a modern book. Some tablets were dated by indicating the dwelling place of the writer at the time that the colophon was written, and these dates are immediately connected with the ending phrase, "These are the generations of." Instances of this found in Genesis are chapter 25, verse 11, "And Isaac dwell in Beer-lahai-roi," chapter 36, verse 8, "And Esau dwell in Mount Seir," chapter 37, verse 1, "And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father sojourned in the land of Canaan." When a correct understanding of this ancient method of dating and the use of catch lines is understood, it will be seen that we have the means of solving such problems as that presented by the wording of Genesis 11, verses 26 and 27, which reads, "And Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the origins of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran." The first statement in these verses has been a great stumbling block to chronologists and commentaries, for as it reads, it implies that when Terah was 70 years old, it was born to him all the three sons named. But Scripture makes it plain this was not so. As revealed by Acts 7, verse 4 and Genesis 12, verse 4, where it is clear that Abram was not born until 60 years later, when Terah was 130 years old. The question might be asked, what means the statement, "Terah lived 70 years"? In conformity with the prevailing writing practice of the time, Terah was only dating his tablet, or indicating that it was written when he was 70 years old. This, of course, implies the acceptance of the Septuagint and Samaritan dates for the death of Nahor, the father of Terah, which occurred 1 year before Terah was 70. The repetition of the names Abram, Nahor, and Haran before and after the formula, or Todadoth, indicates that they are catch lines and conform to the usual practice of repeating the first words of the subsequent tablets after the last line of the preceding tablet. Moreover, it is a common practice in ancient times. When a tablet relating to one's ancestors came into the possession of a descendant, that he should add his own tablet given his own ancestry, so connecting him with the persons and events previously recorded. This is just what Terah had done. He simply added a list of his ancestors. That is in Genesis 11, verses 10 to 27, connecting his with Shem. These literary methods employed in connecting together tablets are precisely those in use in the most ancient times and not the methods prevailing in Palestine during the times the critics state that Genesis was composed. That these ancient literary aids and cuneiform usages are still discernible in Genesis clearly reveal the purity of the text and the care with which it had been handed down to us. It also signifies that in the earliest days or times, these records were written on clay tablets, and that these tablets forming the series of Genesis, chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 37, verse 1, were joined together in the same manner as we have them today. This definitely demolishes the critics' theory that Genesis was composed of documents originally having nothing to do with each other. I will show that all the narratives in Genesis bear the marks of having been written by those who were personally acquainted with the events recorded. The significance of what I've outlined is that these personal histories found in Genesis were not entrusted, as is generally supposed, merely to the memory of man to be handed down century after century by word of mouth. Writing was prevalent at a very early date, and of all the things to be put down in writing, few were of more importance than the events recorded in the early chapters of Genesis. Moreover, we know that in the most ancient times, men concerned themselves with writing about the very things which had been observed to us in the earlier part of Genesis. The stories of creation and the flood were among the earliest, oldest, and most frequently written of the historical tablets. We have tablets written 4,000 years ago relating to the creation and the flood. These were dug up at Kalna, tablets covering Genesis chapter 10. It is true that the accounts are grotesque when compared with Genesis. They were written only 600 years before Moses was born. Even at this date, were only copies of tablets which had been written centuries before that came into the possession of Moses. The 11 tablets that comprise the first 37 chapters of Genesis show of its own origin. The book of Genesis was originally written on clay cuneiform tablets that came into the possession of Moses, undoubtedly handed down from one generation to the succeeding generation. Tablets that were originally written by the patriarchs who were intimately concerned with the events related therein and whose names are clearly stated, and how Moses, as the compiler and editor of the book of Genesis, as we now have it, plainly directed our attention to the source of his information. As I pointed out, the story of Genesis was not entrusted, as is generally supposed, merely to the memory of man to be handed down century after century by word of mouth. I would now like to deal with the tablets themselves, showing where they correspond to the verses in Genesis. Obviously, no one could have written the first series of tablets, Genesis 1, verse 1 to Genesis 2, verse 4, from personal knowledge of the manner in which the world was created. And significantly, it is the only tablets which do not state the name of the author or writer. It simply says, "These are the generations," meaning history, "of the heavens and the earth." The facts contained in the narrative preserved on this tablet were certainly beyond the speculations of time. If it is not a concise account given by God of the order of creation, it is merely a piece of literary guesswork. However, that cannot be the case because the narration contains facts which modern scientific research, aided by the use of modern instruments of marvelous precision and power, have confirmed. We find the wording simple, but the truth conveyed is profound. Using a language that Adam could understand, God taught Adam, in simple words, how the earth and the things he could see on and around it had been created. God talked with Adam in the garden, and the first tablet is a simple record of what God said and did. Adam is told just as much as his mind could understand. The details and processes are not fully revealed. If they had been, Adam would not have understood them. This most ancient piece of writing is simply the record of what God told Adam, teaching him the elementary things about the universe. This is the first instance of written history, for it was written down before even the sun and moon had been given names. We note the simplicity with which the facts are presented, a type of repetition and simplicity rarely reoccurring in the scriptures. For example, "Let there be lights in the firmament, and God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night." Long before the flood of Noah's day, men worshipped the sun and moon and had given them names. Had this first chapter of Genesis been written even as late as Abraham's day, instead of the simple expression, "greater light," we would have seen the Babylonian word for sun, Shamash. Shamash was the name of the sun god worshipped by the Babylonians. Hammurabi, in his code, depicts himself in the attitude of receiving the laws from this Shamash. When Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees, the moon god was the chief object of worship in that city. The great tower built in the center of the city, 250 years before Abraham, was surmounted by a temple dedicated to the moon god. Names for the sun and moon are among the oldest words known in any language, yet the narration of Genesis was written before names had been given to the greater and lesser lights. The earliest or first of the cuneiform tablets is written as recording God's words in telling Adam the story of creation. The method was simple, "and God said," and "God called," and what God called the components of the universe, he places on record. "And God called the light day, and the darkness called the night. And God called the firmament heaven. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called the sea." It is written in the style of one recording precisely what Adam heard when the narrative was told to him.
The Greek version of the Old Testament renders the final sentence of the creation account, "This is the book of the origin of the heavens and the earth." How it came to be written, we are not told, but we are told it was spoken in Eden. Adam, who gave names to the living creatures, could conceivably write this short account in his own simple form of writing. It may have been repeated verbally at first. Obviously, the first part of Genesis was written before myth and legend had time to grow, and not, as is often stated by the critics, at a later date, when it had to be stripped of the mythical and legendary elements, inherent in every other account of creation extant. The account is so original and ancient that it contains nothing Babylonian, Egyptian, or Hebrew. All other extant accounts are merely corrupted copies. Other ancient accounts incorporate their national philosophies in crude, polytheistic, and mythological form, whereas the Genesis chapter 1 is as primitive as man himself and can be considered the threshold of written history. The second tablet, or series of tablets, extends from 5th verse of the 2nd chapter to chapter 5, verse 2, and contains an account of the beginning of man upon the earth, the Garden of Eden, the fall of Adam, and the murder of Abel. These tablets also bear the marks of extreme antiquity and simplicity, which never could have come from a late hand. For instance, the test of obedience is the eating or refraining from eating the fruit of the tree. The tempter is referred to after the fall as a serpent in the dust, a form never afterwards used in the Old Testament, and again, a form that no late writer would likely to employ. Then there are expressions such as sin crouching at the door, in connection with the story of the offerings made by Cain, and the remark of Lamech, "I have slain a young man in my wounding and a young man to my hurt," pointing to a contemporary event that we are given no explanation. Again, it is very unlikely any late writer would have used such intimate language as "the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day." The one person who knew all the facts about the fall is stated to be the source from which this account came. This second tablet takes the story up to the birth of the sons of Lamech. Soon after this, Adam died, and the concluding words on the tablet are, "This is the book of the origins of Adam." The third tablet, or a series of tablets, comprises chapter 5, verse 3, to chapter 6, verse 9, and commences with the genealogical register of the patriarchs connecting Noah with Adam. Similar genealogical lists appear in the oldest tablets unearthed, many of which can be seen in various museums in the world. This list is followed by a statement concerning the corruption extant in Noah's day, together with an explanation of the cause of it. Undoubtedly, this tablet was written by Noah, and in verses 9 of chapter 6, he wrote, "These are the generations," again meaning origins, "of Noah," which is a small tablet of narrative writings added to the genealogical list. The fourth tablet, or series of tablets, forms chapter 6, verse 9, to chapter 10, verse 1. The story commences in a Babylonian scene and ends outside that country. Although for the first time we have moved beyond the confines of the ancient Mesopotamian plain, the writer does not take us to Palestine, but to Ararat. We also find the use of that exceptional word, gopher wood, mentioned in the construction of the ark. This is a most archaic word, a word never again used in the Bible. The tablet ends with the statement, "These are the generations," meaning origins, or family histories, "of the sons of Noah." These tablets are almost wholly taken up with the account of the flood. The flood story has received considerable attention from the higher critics, who assert that it was borrowed from Babylonia. Much has been made of the so-called two accounts. Some have even identified three accounts, interwoven into the narrative. They base their idea on such passages as chapter 7, verse 18, "And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth." Verse 20, 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail. Then in verse 21, "And all flesh died that moved upon the face of the earth." verse 22, and in whose nostrils was the breath of life, and all that was in the dry land died. And finally in verse 23, and every living substance was destroyed, and so forth. These separate accounts are easily explained by the fact that the narrative is the history of the three sons of Noah and written into the series of tablets. We note that an examination of the account reveals every indication that it was written by eyewitnesses of the tragedy. The fifth tablet, or series of tablets, is contained in chapter 10, verse 2 to chapter 11, verse 9, and includes the famous 10th chapter with the outline of the tribes or clans which became nations. In this chapter, we have a brief statement about Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. In the 11th chapter, we have an account of the building of the Tower of Babel and the scattering of the people. Of these records, it is written, these are the generations, again meaning histories, of Shem. We have already seen the significance of the seemingly abrupt ending of his genealogical list with the, quote, sons of Jotan. And the repetition and completing of it is Terah's tablet. This tablet of Shem is an outline of developments during the 500 years after the flood. The tablets containing the register of lands was written in Shem's time. A Babylonian tablet written 600 years before Abraham is in the British Museum and corroborates the scriptural account. In chapter 11, verse 10 to 27, we have the genealogical register belonging to Terah. It gives a list of his ancestors connecting him with Shem, the son of Noah. The next and longest division, tablets containing chapters 11, verse 27 to chapter 25, verse 12, is followed by a postscript of seven verses. These are verses 13 to 19. In accordance with the usual custom, Moses has placed the name of Abraham's eldest son Ishmael, verse 12, before that of Isaac, the heir, verse 19. A similar arrangement is in the next section, places Esau before Jacob. In both instances, they were brothers. It is also noticed in Numbers 3, verse 1, that in a similar way he places Aaron, his elder brother, before himself. The whole section contains records written by and belonging both to Isaac and Ishmael. It commences with Terah begat Abraham and ends with, and his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah. The intervening chapters are a narrative of all we know about the life of Abraham, the central figure of the book of Genesis. Abraham alone could have recounted most of the instances, but it appears that his sons wrote them down, or at least the copies of which Moses had before him belonged to them. The whole story is written with great familiarity and detail. For instance, the visit of the three men recorded in the 18th chapter, quote, as he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood over against him, and when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door, and bowed himself to the earth and said, and so on, carry on, and he hastened into the tent unto Sarah and said, make ready quickly three measures of the fine meal. And Abraham ran to the herd and fetched a calf, tender and good, and gave it unto his servant, who hasted to dress it, and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. Unquote. The remainder of the chapter is an intimate personal account of Abraham's prayer for Sodom. After the destruction of Sodom, we read in chapter 19, verse 27-28, and Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord, and he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and toward the land of the plain, and behold, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as smoke of a furnace. The style here is just what we would expect of Abraham, relating the incidences to Isaac, who is stated to have owned the tablets recording them. The following section, or tablets, chapter 25, verse 19, to chapter 36, verse 1, is followed by two proscripts contained in chapter 36 concerning Esau in Canaan and Mount Seir. This section, including the postscripts, are records left by Jacob and Esau. The greater part of the story concerns Jacob and more than half of it refers to his journey to and from Padam Aram and his life there. He alone could have recorded the events occurring during this period of his life. There is a question as to who wrote the last 14 chapters of Genesis. It is mainly the history of Joseph in Egypt, and the record begins with the words, "And Joseph being 17 years old," and ends with, "And he," meaning Joseph, "was put in a coffin in Egypt." This section contains many purely Egyptian words and phrases, as well as intimate references to Egyptian life. In this section, we have passed from the Babylonian to Egypt, where in all probability, it would have been written on papyrus. We note that unlike the other sections, it has no ending formula to indicate who the author is. What I have presented in this study has its critics who claim that the compositions of the early books of the Bible are completely at variance with the statements of the scriptures themselves. This school of thought is known as higher criticism, to distinguish it from the textual or lower criticism, which deals with questions of text and translation. Because higher criticism is accepted in certain quarters today, I should address this subject. One critical attack against Genesis is that the book is a purified form of the Babylonian records found in cuneiform tablets. Excavators in Iraq have found many tablets containing accounts of the creation and the flood. The versions given in these tablets differ considerably from the Bible account. An examination shows that the Bible account is simple in its ideas and teachings about God, whereas the Babylonian tablets are complex and polytheistic. The question rises, why then do the critics adopt the attitude that the Genesis account of creation and the flood are purified copies of the Babylonian tablets? The answer is simple. Having taken up the critical attitude, which alleges that Genesis must have been written at a late date, they are forced by this supposition to say that the narratives were borrowed from Babylonia. Notwithstanding the fact that the Bible account is unquestionably simpler, pure, and superior. Resemblances to the accounts do exist, but the Babylonian similarities are embedded in a mass of corrupt and graceless mythologies, with miscellaneous gods, wrangling in jealous rivalry, and grotesque conceptions of the universe. An example is found in the fourth tablet of the Babylonian story of creation. The lines which contain the nearest resemblance to the biblical story of creation are, "Marduk resting, viewing her corpse, in parting the corpse, conceiving a cunning plan. He split her like a mashed fish into two parts. With the half he established and guarded the heavens. He drew the boat, he placed a guard. He directed them not to let her waters escape. He passed over the heavens, he circled the regions. He set before Apsu the dwelling of Nudumrud." Babylonian tablets on the flood do have some closer similarities. They are, 1, the flood, a punishment for sin. 2, command to build a ship to preserve life. 3, use of Bittim to make the ship watertight. 4, grounding of the ship upon a mountain. And 5, offering sacrifice. The main framework of the story agrees with that of Genesis, but there the agreement ends. As apart from this, the Babylonian account is mainly crude, polytheistic quarreling with reference to a host of scheming gods who are stated to cower like dogs, crowd like flies. The pure original version, as we have in Genesis, has become so corrupted, confused, and distorted as to be, other than in its framework, deformed beyond recognition. It is sometimes said by the critics that the patriarchs borrowed their religion from the nations around them. The opposite is true. Instead of accepting the religions of the nations around them, they deliberately rejected those cults. The Israelites were warned many times against copying the corrupt cults of the peoples around them. Leviticus 28 verse 3 reads, "After the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein ye dwell, ye shall not do, and after the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall ye not do." To summarize what we have covered in this on Bible and archaeology, we have established that the book of Genesis was 1, written originally on clay cuneiform tablets, an ancient script of the time. 2, by the patriarchs intimately acquainted with the events related. 3, that Moses was a compiler of the book as we now have it. 4, that Moses plainly directs attention to the source of his information. 5, archaeological research, which commenced after higher criticism had produced its theories, has produced the ancient and contemporary background of Genesis, which wholly agrees with its contents. 6, the Genesis narratives imply that rapid developments took place in early history. Archaeologists have dug down into virgin soil and found a high state of culture existing at times previously called prehistoric. So as far back as archaeology had been able to go, and in the earliest times, examples of writings have been found. During the period covered by the greater part of Genesis, writing has been discovered to be in common use, even for ordinary commercial transactions. 7, we now know that something of the literary methods used by the ancient writers. Prominent among these was a colophon of the tablets. In our examination of Genesis, we find a similar literary method for the formula. These are the origins of the ancient conclusion which Moses inserted, indicating the source from which he obtained the narratives and genealogies. 8, other literary methods we noted was the use of titles and catch lines in order to bring the tablets together in proper sequence. Although Genesis, as we now have it, is a book compiled by Moses, there are still traces of the use of these literary means of observing the sequence. 9, in some instances, indications are provided given the date when the tablet was written. This is given in a most archaic way and very similar to the method prevailing in very ancient times. 10, we also noted that in no instance is an event recorded which the person or persons named could not have written from intimate personal knowledge or to obtain absolutely unmistakable contemporary information. 11, additional correlation is found in the significant fact that the history recorded in the sections written over the names of the patriarchs ceases in all instances on the date on which the tablet is stated to have been written, or where no date is given, before the date of that person or death of that person. In most cases, it is continued almost up to the date of the patriarch's death. 12, the presence of Babylonian words in the first 11 chapters of Genesis is a further testimony that the contents of the earliest narratives and genealogies were written during the lifetime of the early patriarchs, during the time that they used that language. 13, the presence of Egyptian words and customs in the last 14 chapters of Genesis adds this confirming testimony that those chapters were written in Egypt. 14, the very first tablet, that of creation, seems to have been written at the very dawn of history. This is evidenced by its archaic expressions, for it was put down into writing before names had been given to the sun and moon, and before polytheism had arisen or clans developed. And last, 13, 15, there is no statement in Scripture to support the supposition that all the narratives and genealogies were handed down verbally. On the contrary, they claim to have been written down. Higher criticism originated on the basis of the changes in the use of the divine name and title. However, when it is understood that Genesis is composed of a series of tablets, as indicated by the formula, these are the origins of, and so forth, it will be seen that it aids in a most significant way in explaining the remarkable use of the name and title given to Jehovah God. In our examination of the first tablet, we found that the only divine name on it is God. Also that the contents of this tablet was a personal revelation to Adam. At the dawn of history, it was sufficient to use the name God, for all at that time there were no other gods, so that a name in addition to the title was obviously unnecessary in the first tablet. The second tablet, written, as we noted, before the beginning of the flood, contains both the title of God and the name Jehovah. In this tablet, the name and title are always used together except by the tempter and Eve, and this exclusive combining use is peculiar to this tablet. This is undoubtedly due to the revelation given during this period. or the cuneiform equivalent of the title El Shaddai, now translated in our modern Bible as Jehovah. It was of the days of Adam's grandson Enoch that we read, "Then begin men to call upon the name of Jehovah." Hence, in this tablet, we have both a name and a title for God. The most probable reason is that at this time men begin to worship other gods, so that then a distinguishing name become a necessity. Critics have conjectured Genesis was written by several writers at different times because of the divine name changes. One writer using the name Elohim, while another Jehovah, and because certain passages were obviously written by the same writer, they came up with the conjecture that there was a third writer who took pieces out of each of the others. The only logical explanation is that Moses came into possession of the tablets of his predecessors written in the cuneiform script prevalent of their day. Naturally, on some of them was a cuneiform equivalent for God. The word God is used 34 times in the tablet of creation, and no other divine title or name is used. In other tablets, he would find an additional, the cuneiform equivalent of El Shaddai, meaning God Almighty or All-Sufficient, a name by which Exodus 6 verse 3 plainly states he appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Perhaps it should be pointed out that the word God is not a name, it is a title. Jehovah was the name of God. This distinction may be seen in the second commandment. Thou shalt not take the name of Jehovah thy God in vain. The Jews took this commandment literally and substituted the word Adonai for it. Translated Lord in the same translation, when men began to make gods to distinguish them from each other, they gave each a name. By the time of Moses, the names of over 80 Babylonian gods were worshipped. It should be pointed out that in the scriptures, the name Jehovah is God's restrictive name used only by himself. However, his appointed Israel was given the right to use the name Jehovah. The first instance is found in chapter 2, verse 4, translated in the King James text as Lord. Verse 4 reported what God had created.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you were fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our costs plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.